I'm at the training facility of the Baltimore Ravens American Football Club. The main building here is at the end of a sweeping driveway and actually gives the look of an exclusive country club. The lobby has deep leather sofas and, of course, the Super Bowl is proudly on display. I'm here to meet the head coach, John Harbaugh. He's at the tip of a network of specialist coaches, something like a CEO of a big multinational or the conductor trying to bring parts of an orchestra together. Harbaugh is unlike the other coaches in our series who either work with individuals or small teams, so I'm keen to know how he brings together all the different parts of this huge machine. Now, as I walk around this complex, past the gym, just here where some of the players are starting their preparations for the upcoming season, there are motivational messages on some of the walls which really go to the heart of the philosophy here. This one just says, win, and just behind me, there's another message here which quite simply says, the team, the team, the team. And it really just reminds everyone what is the ultimate goal. It is just over a year since the Ravens, with Harbaugh as the coach, won the Super Bowl, the huge annual championship-deciding extravaganza, which is held in this country, but watched by millions around the world. So how was it that John Harbaugh was able to step out of the family's shadows to become one of the most successful leaders in this game? Well, I'm about to meet him, heading up through the bowels of the building to the office complex to learn more about this inspirational coach who's made the team so successful.
The Super Bowl belongs to Baltimore.
John Harbaugh, welcome to the Managers. You have really quite a complex here, don't you?
Well, thanks for having me, and we do. This is a pretty special facility. I think that's probably why everybody here calls it the castle. And we're pretty proud of it.
And I was struck, and I referred to them, the motivational messages that you have around. I mean, as I said, reminding people what the ultimate goal is.
Well, I think the whole thing is really well thought out, you know, from the style of the building to the design of the building to the cultural, like you say, messaging around the building. But the building is set up to reflect a professionalism. I mean, it looks probably more like a law firm than it does a football building. And that's by design. I think when our players come in here and people come in here, they realize they're part of something very special. You know, this is a business. It's a big business, and it's important, and you need to come to work, you know, and take pride in where you're at. And then it's all set up around the players. The players are the middle of the building. The locker room and the training room, the two are the central focus of the building, and everything branches out from there. Every meeting room, weight room, practice field branches out from the epicenter, which is where the players are at. And then the messaging, you know, we try to build a common view, a way of looking at the world, a kind of a prism, a culture. And those things are just kind of reminders of what we stand for, what we're all about, how we see things. There's always a method to every madness.
Now, for you, the job that you have now, it has been quite a journey, hasn't it?
Sure. Everybody's on a journey.
And some would say for you, at times, an unglamorous journey. There have been as many lows as there have been highs.
Yes. So there should always probably be more lows. There's more valleys than peaks in life, right? We can't survive very long at the peak, but it's been a great ride. We grew up in a football family. My brother and I, my sister, my dad's a coach. We've been around locker rooms our whole lives. We've been around players and coaches. It's a very natural place for us to be. You know, we kind of understand how guys think, you know, in the world of football. So it's been, like everybody goes through, you have fights in life and stuff like that. But, you know, in the end, God's got a plan. I believe in providence. And, you know, he takes us on the journeys that he takes us for a reason. And it's always fun to see where the destination is.
As a child growing up in that environment, how did it affect you?
Well, we thought we were the greatest, luckiest kids on the face of the earth. And we could have been the king's kids, you know, could have been the president's kids. We were the coach's kid, you know, and our dad was usually an assistant coach at a college, high school before that. We were around every locker room, you know. My dad would bring, players would come over for dinner, bring their girlfriends or wives, their kids sometimes over for dinner. We get stuffed into lockers. We got taped to goalposts, you know. We've just been in that environment, and we were the kids that had it all in our eyes. It was, my dad had a saying, you know, always, my brother still uses it a lot to this day. He'd always shout, you know, who's got it better than us? And our job was to shout, nobody, as loud as we could, you know, and that's how we approached life. Well, it was sports all the time. I mean, it mattered to us, you know, it was a big deal. I'm trying to find a way to say, well, you know, we had other things in our life, but we really didn't. I mean, it was, you had to go to school and get good grades. We had the Cub Scouts for a while, but my dad was the kind of dad that really didn't help us with anything. He took us fishing one time when we were at the University of Iowa. We made a big deal about he was going to take us fishing. Took us down to the Iowa River. We walked down the bank. We threw our lines in the water. It couldn't have been 10 minutes. And he pulled the lines out and said, oh, boys, they aren't biting today. It's the last time we ever went fishing, you know. Never been hunting. I mean, hunting. But we were, you know, we would play 21, which is a basketball pickup game in our driveway.
How competitive were you and your brother at that stage?
Oh, I mean, we had legendary fights, Jim and I. It was, you know, people tell stories that other coaches wouldn't let us come over to their house because we got in these massive fights in their driveway. And, you know, I guess some things don't change.
Tell us a little bit more about your dad.
Well, my dad started off, he coached in a number of high schools in Ohio, started out in junior high school, actually. Then he went to small colleges in Ohio and Kentucky, coached at University of Iowa, University of Michigan. Was a head coach at two schools. So we were just with him on that journey all those years. And my mom was a cheerleader. My dad played on the team. My mom was a cheerleader.
And what were his influences? Who were the people that guided his career?
The biggest influence he had in college was a coach by the name of Bo Schembechler. Bo was a legendary coach at the University of Michigan. Tremendous leader, old school coach in the Midwestern football, you know, 60s and 70s and 80s. Style football. I think that's where Jim and I get our beliefs from pretty much every single day.
No man is more important than the team. No coach is more important than the team. The team, the team, the team. And if we think that way, all of us, everything that you do, you take into consideration what effect does it have on my team.
And Bo wrote up a lot of these stories in his book, Lasting Lessons, which is a book that stayed with you.
Well, when I first got the job here 6 years ago, we gave Bo's Lasting Lessons to everybody in the organization just to give them an idea of what our foundation was, you know, so that they had a sense of why we were talking about the things we were talking about. When we first came in and we said that we were going to be about three things. We were going to be about the team, the team, the team, and those were going to be the three things we were going to be about. I wanted them to understand what that meant.
We're going to win the championship again. Because we're going to play as a team. Better than anybody else in this conference, we're going to play together as a team. When the old season is over, you and I know it's going to be Michigan again. Michigan.
Is that the best lesson that you learned from him? Were there others that come to mind?
Yeah, I think that's the number one thing. Everything flows from that umbrella, from that foundation, that philosophy, that building block is what it's all about for us. And then you can take it in any direction you want. Everything comes back to, you know, what is best for the team and being a part of something bigger than yourself and sacrificing or making yourself smaller than the guys around you. Because when you do that, when you're willing to do everything you can to plug into the guy next to you or the five guys around you, plug into those guys, allow their light to shine, well, you shine five times or 53 times as bright. That's what it's all about. And that's what people remember you for. If you think back in your life, I mean, you remember the people that made the difference in your life. If you make a difference in somebody else's life, I mean, you know, that's what leadership's all about.
Have you modeled your career to some extent on Bo? It strikes me that you're different personalities. He was a yeller. He would shout. He was tough in that respect, which maybe doesn't reflect, I think, your personality.
No, yeah. You know, one thing, I kind of got a thing I do with the guys, but we say principles are written in stone, methods are not. You know, and one thing my dad learned, my dad got his first head coaching job at Western Michigan. And like a lot of guys that left Bo's staff, he went on and tried to emulate Bo. And what happens is you take on some of those personality traits and you reflect that style because that's what you've been around. To me, that's a very natural thing. And it's a huge mistake that coaches or teachers make all the time. My dad learned that lesson at Western Michigan. He changed it when he went to Western Kentucky as a head coach. And the principles were the same, but he used his style, his personality. Good or bad, you know, we all got things that people like and things that they don't like. But you know, I was blessed enough because of my dad's experience to learn from that right out of the gates. And you don't try to be somebody you're not. You got to be yourself.
Can you give us, maybe put some perspective on just how important college sport is in this country?
It's an interesting phenomenon in our country, the way that sports is tied together with our educational system. I think we believe that competition, physical education, the team value system, character building, is part of our educational system. Personally, I'm a coach. I think it's a great thing. And the teams become a vital part of the community. High school football in Ohio, Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania, it's big. It's a Friday night lights. It becomes part of the community coming together, cheering for the team, complaining about the coach, talking about the players. You run through the tunnel and you run through the paper circle with the band playing and the mascot jumping around, and you're a high school kid, or you're in the band and you're a part of it, or you're in the student section and you're a part of it.
You were a political science major, weren't
right.
you? And your mother thought that that's what you were destined to do. What, become a lawyer or a politician? Maybe?
Yeah, lawyer, politician. I'm sure she thought I was going to be the president someday, you know? Heavy into, you know, like Hegel and Rousseau and on the one end, and Adam Smith on the other, and Thomas Jefferson. So I really believe a lot of what we do stems from culture building and philosophy toward society and the way people interact with one another and those things. And, you know, it's amazing. You don't think it's going to be too important sometimes, your education. And then for the next 30, 40 years, you find yourself thinking about those things that you pondered and wrote papers on when you were in college.
Do you still draw upon that political science training in the job that you do now?
Absolutely. I mean, to me, it's a foundation of who I am. You know, it's a, you know, your belief system, you know, is who you are. And that colors everything. There's a philosophy, there's a theology, there's just a way of looking at the world that when you educate or you try to train or you try to bring people together, you've got to draw on something, you know, and if you don't believe in something, you know, you'll fall for anything, I guess, is kind of the cliche. But, you know, we've had a lot of conversations lately about civil rights, you know, because a lot of the conversations that are going on in our country right now, it's an ongoing thing. And, you know, I've been trained in, you know, the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Revolution, the quote-unquote great original sin of this country, the Civil War, right through the Civil Rights Movement. You know, that hits home with the young generation right now. It's trying to figure out what that's all about. Our young people don't understand how far we've come in this country. You know, I'm 51 years old now. I had a chance to live through the latter stages of that. You know, I was alive when the civil rights laws were enacted. My parents were lived in a different world that way. And to be able to relate that in a philosophical way to our players so that they can understand, hey, when we're interacting with one another in a locker room, when you say certain things to one another, you take certain positions, do you really know what you're saying? Do you really understand what's behind those words? Let's talk about that. I mean, to me, it's a great tool, great advantage.
So at what stage did you know, you knew yourself, that football was your future?
Well, when you play football, and it's probably like any sport, right? You just feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. You're part of a team. You've got a family, you know, and it's your guys and the guys in the team that you're with. And they mean everything to you, and you've got lifelong friendships. And if those guys are in trouble to this day, you're there for them and they're there for you. So I think what happens to guys who want to go into coaching, and even I would think in business and some other things, you try to recreate that, but it's never the same. You want to still be a part of that. You still want to be a part of a team. You want to be a part of something that's bigger than yourself. And so as a player, you just don't want to let that go. So what's the next thing? When they tell you you can't play anymore because you're not good enough, you go, okay, can I coach? You know, and once I got done playing, I was going to follow my mom, what my mom wanted. I was going to go to law school. But my dad asked me to come coach with his team, and it took me about 3 weeks to figure out that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
At that point, do you think you were learning how to be a coach almost subconsciously, that it was by osmosis,
rather than
reading a textbook about it? You were learning from all these characters around you.
It's like, to me, coaching, you learn. It's like learning life. I mean, you learn some principles definitely through the book, but you learn life through experience, you know, and through mistakes and stuff like and successes and things, interactions, all through childhood days, just growing up, being around our dad, watching our dad interact with his players. You just learn by osmosis. It just kind of becomes a part of who you are. You think when you're a player that you know the game. I mean, you think you really know just about everything there is to know about the game. Then you start coaching and you find out you really know nothing about the game. And you really have to be willing to humble yourself, go back to square one, start from scratch, and start learning the whole thing from the ground up. It's kind of dual railed in the sense of you're talking about on one rail, grace, and on the other rail, accountability. And the things that are tying those two rails together are those ties of relationship. You've got to build on those two things. So you got to believe in your people. You got to teach them to believe in themselves. Teach them to believe in one another. Teach them to believe in something bigger. You know, the team, a spirit, a soul, God, Creator, all those things that are kind of subliminal and beyond our natural ability to understand. You got to build a faith. That's what a team is basically, you know, built on. And then accountability. I mean, there's a high standard. There's an expectation, and you've got to stay on that rail of accountability. You can't veer to the left or to the right. You got to travel far, and you got to travel fast, and you got to travel together, and you have a chance then to compete for something special.
We've talked a little bit about your playing career, but let's discuss that in a little bit more.
My playing career? It won't take long. My playing career was short and uneventful.
You have a sense of humor about it then.
Yeah. I did my best. You know? I ended up playing in Miami. I was an okay high school football player, got hurt a lot in high school, but then I got an opportunity to go to Miami. I had a chance to go to a couple different schools, and I told my dad, he said, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go to the best football school, which turned out to be a very good school academically as well. Miami's a great university, but it was also the best football school that was recruiting me, so that's where I went. And turned out not to be quite good enough to play there as much as I wanted, but sure fought like crazy and competed. You know, I tried to be the best player I could be, and it just didn't work for me. Of course, you know, you go through everything, and you know, like any failure in life, it's whose fault is it? You know, and to this day, you know, I'm happy to point the finger, you know, but the reality is I wasn't good enough to play. But as I was going through that, I realized I was going to be good at something. I was as good as I could be. So at some point in time, I had the respect of my teammates, but I could do well in school. So about halfway through, I decided, well, I'll tell you what, I know I can be the best student on this team. So I think I got one B in this last 2 years there, which kind of ticked me off. It was a B plus in political philosophy. It was my favorite class. So
are two types of failure, aren't there? There's one kind of failure, which I think is what you're talking about, where you're just not good at something. I do sports. I can run a marathon, but I can't play football very well. I think it's just the way that I'm made. Right. And then there's a kind of failure where you just don't try hard enough, but you could actually do it if you wanted. As a player, you just couldn't achieve it. But as a coach, you worked extremely hard and you had the success. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's probably life. I walked out of that experience with my head held high and with the respect of the people in that program to this day, you know. And I fought like crazy right to the end. There were times when you just get so frustrated you want to walk away, but I wasn't going to do it. And I had successes, you know, relatively speaking, right up to the end, and that, you know, personally, that I'm proud of. You know, now someone else might go, you weren't a very good player. Well, you know what I can think? I can laugh about it and say it's true, but I understand. You know, you understand your own situation. And then during that time as a student, I said, you know what, I can be a great student, so I'm gonna be the best student on this football team. So you know what, you take pride in something, but you never walk away. You never blame somebody else. You never quit. You never back down. And the truth of the matter is that experience prepared me for this experience here. When you face tough times, when we faced difficult times together as a leader, I understood I wasn't going to back down. And there was no way that any little bit of failure was ever going to discourage. We don't even use the word discourage or disheartened here. Those two words, you cannot take away our courage and you cannot take away our heart. Those two words do not exist. Without our own permission, those things remain ours. We can be disappointed. And we can fail or whatever. We have a joke. I mean, they can kill you, but they can't make you quit.
When you first started working for your dad, it was the lowest of the low in terms of positions. Is it right you weren't even being paid at that point?
Right.
What were you actually doing?
I didn't deserve to be paid. You know, I was coaching the running backs because the beauty of it was he didn't have that many coaches on his staff. So here I am, 21 years old. I was younger than a couple of the guys coaching the running backs, which is a position I had never played before in my life. So I was lucky because my dad was a coach and I got to walk right in the door and coach a position now for 31 years. But I also had to do all the dirty work and all the leg work and all the menial jobs too.
And I think I saw somewhere that one of your jobs was to look after the 16mm tape that was used to analyze the games. You were using technology even in those days. But things didn't always go as they should have gone.
No, when you're a young coach, I mean, they had the 16mm tape and the thing was always silver side up. Because basically, if you remember the old reel-to-reel film, if you put it on backwards or upside down, it's not going to look right, you know? And it's really hard to see that. And if you're a young guy, you know, as young people, we don't usually check our work too often. So no matter how many warnings you get as a young guy, you think it's right and it's not right, and then you get made fun of pretty good. As the coach's kid, I got probably double, but the dexterity in your fingers when you're cutting up the 16mm tape, it amazes me the technology now with the computers and what we're able to do now and how primitive it was back then.
And was there an incident where a decision went against you and your dad's team?
Oh, come on. Can't believe you're going to go there on this one. Yeah, you know, I mean, you're a fiery young coach. You think you know everything. And we were in the heat of battle, and we're playing Ohio University down in Athens, full house, big game. And we're down by 6, and we're driving for the winning score. And we got flagged twice for holding after big plays. I mean, these are bad calls, okay? Some things don't change in our sport. And so, you know, I have headsets on. And I'm 22 years old, and I rip my headsets off, and I throw them as far as I can down behind the bench onto the track, you know, and now I don't have headsets, you know, and I'm kind of like, oh, what do I do now? And just as I turn around, my dad is right in my face. I mean, he's an inch. His nose is probably touching my nose. And he's got these, and when my dad gets mad now, he gets these wrinkles in his forehead, and his eyes get to be really small and really black. And that's when, like, we've seen that look before. And he just looked me right in the eye and he said, go get him. And I'm like, the phones? And he just looks at me like, doesn't even answer. So I got to turn around, and all the players are looking at me, you know, and they're hurting, but they're kind of snickering probably. They thought it was a bad call too. And I got to run down behind our bench in front of the Ohio University band and student section and pick those headphones up, because they saw them flying through the air, and pick those up and jog back with my tail between my legs and just getting catcalled and hooted on the whole way. Quite a moment.
So there was some tough love in terms of your early training days. You did eventually make the transition to be a coach, and I suppose the pinnacle of your career here now in Baltimore. We will pause. We'll come back in a moment after the latest news headlines to talk about how you made that transition and ultimately achieve the ultimate goal in this sport.
Documentaries on the BBC World Service.
I saw the temple last
in 1984, the Indian army stormed the Golden Temple, the most holy place of Sikh worship. Mark Tully reported from there for the BBC.
It's quite clear to me that the siege of the temple.
The aim was to oust Sikh extremists, but Prime Minister Indira Gandhi paid a heavy price for ordering the attack.
Indira Gandhi, ruler of the world's largest democracy, died today, shot down by two of her own bodyguards. They were Sikhs taking revenge for the invasion.
And many died in anti-Sikh riots across India.
The violence in 1984 left a traumatic imprint on the memory of the entire targeted collective.
In the first program, Mark Tully examines the events and the underlying issues. Gunfire over the Golden Temple. Online from Tuesday at bbcworldservice.com.
American football is one of the things that defines this country. It's watched around the globe. The winners of the end-of-season finale are called the world champions, but only teams from the US compete. I'm Peter Bowes, and in the second half of my conversation with John Harbaugh for the managers, I'll be talking more about his journey from coach's son to a Super Bowl-winning coach himself beating his own brother. That's still to come after the latest news here on the BBC World Service.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. Islamist gunmen from Al-Shabaab have carried out a concerted attack on the Somali parliament in the capital Mogadishu, killing at least 8 people. Witnesses said that heavily armed gunmen stormed the compound after a car bomb was detonated at the entrance. Attackers also fired from the roof of a nearby mosque. MPs were evacuated from the building. Thailand's new military rulers have dissolved the country's Senate in a further step to consolidate power after a coup. The move gives full legislative power to the army, which has already dissolved the lower house of parliament, suspended the constitution, and arrested senior politicians. 6 people have been killed in a series of drive-by shootings in the US city of Santa Barbara. Eyewitnesses described a black BMW speeding through the streets, spraying bullets at people. Police said the suspected gunman was later found dead inside the car. Pakistan's Prime Minister has accepted an invitation to the inauguration of his Indian counterpart, Narendra Modi, on Monday. It's the first such move since independence in 1947. Activists in Syria have again accused the government of using chlorine gas in attacks in 2 separate locations. The government has denied the allegations. Pope Francis has urged a peaceful solution to the Syrian conflict. He's in Jordan at the start of a 3-day visit to the Middle East. The president of Malawi, Joyce Banda, has declared this week's presidential and parliamentary elections null and void, saying there'd been rampant fraud and irregularities. Mrs. Banda said she wouldn't stand in the new poll. South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, has been sworn in for a second term. He promised his government would boost economic growth and employment. The Italian city of Florence is hosting the much-talked-about showbiz wedding of the US reality TV star Kim Kardashian and the rapper Kanye West. They've hired a Renaissance fortress for the event. BBC News.
Welcome back to The Managers on the BBC World Service. I'm Peter Bowes in Maryland on the east coast of the United States, where I'm talking to the head coach of the 2013 Super Bowl winning Baltimore Ravens, John Harbaugh. John, how did you get the coaching job at this great club here?
I got the job because one guy, the owner, Steve Bisciotti, saw something that nobody else saw and hired a guy probably that nobody else would hire back 6 years ago. And I think he feels like he made the right decision.
The guy that no one would hire? Did you see that in yourself?
Well, yeah, you know, there's a kind of a path in our sport through usually coaching the quarterbacks, becoming an offensive coordinator, or even a defensive coordinator to becoming a head coach. My career was different. You know, I usually was the guy that would coach the stuff that nobody else wanted to coach. So if they said, hey, who's going to coach the punt team? I coached the punt team. Who's going to coach the kickoff return team? I coached the kickoff return team. You know, and it wasn't really the smartest path for becoming a head coach. And it looked like at one time it was going to be a dead end. But, you know, the Ravens decided to bring me in for an interview. You know, 2 interviews and a guy or two turning it down later, you know, they got stuck with me.
How do you, at that point, reach a level in your career where you accepted the status quo and that you really didn't ever think you would hit the big time?
Well, I didn't accept it. I mean, I always felt like I could do it, and I was always preparing for it. So, you know, always took notes, always talked to different people, always watched my boss, Andy Reid, always made plans for how I would do it. So when the interview came around, you know, I was prepared for it. And I had a plan, and I knew the Ravens team. We talk about principles being written in stone. I had a foundation of principles that would apply to this team and that Steve Bisciotti, the owner here, happened to be looking for. So it wasn't like I went in there and said, hey, here's what they want to hear.
How did you initially go about motivating the guys, or putting it another way, getting their respect? And especially when they know right. who you were as a player, and it was not a successful career, right. to gain their respect, and they are at the top of their game, achieving more as players than you ever did.
Yeah, you know, you're going to have to ask them that. I think it just goes with hopefully being good at what you do and having a good plan, you know, believing in what I believed in and not being willing to back down from what I knew was right, and then building relationships every single day, having grace towards their shortcomings, but at the same time holding them to a high standard and being accountable, at the same time getting to know their families and making their families welcome. But also there's a certain knowledge that goes with it too. It's not like I said, when you're a player, you may or may not have a real good feel for what the game really is. You know, after 25 years of coaching, you've learned a little bit of football. You have some pretty good ideas. Once they see them begin to work, you know, that starts to gain a little momentum for you.
So it's a belief in yourself, knowing that you have the knowledge and that you're going to do the right thing.
Absolutely. You have to believe in yourself. But in order to believe in yourself, I think the first thing is that someone's got to believe in you. My dad always believed in us. You know, my dad and mom. My mom, maybe my mom even more than my dad, They always told us that we could be great at anything we wanted to do. That all we needed to do was be tough and persistent, work hard, be honest, be loyal. We could do anything.
Can we talk about the structure of coaching, how it works, not only here, but throughout the sport? You are the head coach, and you have other coaches, a lot of other coaches, working underneath you with certain specialities. Can you explain that structure?
It's probably hard to visualize it if you don't know the game, because it's such a unique sport. Football is a very big game. It's basketball is 5 people. Baseball is 9 people, and they're very individualized. Football is 11 people. It's 22 people at the same time. There's no lines. You know, you don't hit the ball and run down a line. You can take any path, any track. The combinations multiply enormously. There's a lot of ways things can go. So strategically, you know, just put 11 people going against 11 different people and figure out all the different ways you can move them around. Then take the physiology of the game. Within that, the structure of it's hand-to-hand combat. You know, one man going against another in a physical way. And there's all kind of different. There's blockers, and there's runners, and there's pass routes, and there's covering the pass routes. And then within that, everybody's got to work together. So there's a coordination to it all. So there's a complexity to the game that the more you learn, the more you realize that you really don't know. It's quite a bit of machinery. And as a head coach, you've got your arms around all that machinery.
That always happens! Why does that happen? Golly! Come on! Dean, I don't think we've played cover one against these guys.
You've got an offensive coordinator who's responsible for the offense, a defensive coordinator who's responsible for the defense as a whole, and a special teams coordinator who's responsible for the kicking game as a whole. And then within that, you've got position coach who work like spokes around the wheel with the offensive coordinator. So the coordinator is responsible for tying his unit together, his 11-plus guys together in a coordinated, so they can execute. Mm-hmm. Same thing on defense, same thing on special teams. My job is to tie those three phases together into a coherent team. So the way I visualize the way the thing works is I've got a relationship. It's like a triangle, but it's a lot of different triangles going on. So it's more like a really multifaceted pyramid. So if we could draw that geometrical figure somehow, I think it'd be pretty cool if we could figure out a way to draw it. But to me, that's how the head coach's role is. So you've got a hierarchy, but you've also got a flat plane as well.
So the position coach and every other character in this complex web, their responsibility is ultimately to follow through on your vision of what ultimately happens in the game.
Right, right. You've got to lead the vision. But the vision is created by all of us. We're all contributing to the vision, and that's what communication is all about. That's if we're running communication on those lines, if we're running communication back and forth and across, and like you say, through that web, you know, it's like electrical, it's going through there. Now we got a chance. We've got a chance to all be on the same grid and execute together.
And there's essentially a playbook to execute this plan.
Well, yeah, we have plays. I mean, there are plays, but it's the thing about a playbook is it's a living, breathing organism. It's not a book that you throw on the table that lasts for the next 100 years, you know, like War and Peace or something. This is strategy. It's like war in a sense it's not war, don't get me wrong here, but strategically, you know, you make your plans and then the first shot is fired, then all the plans change. But you gotta stick with the principles of what you're trying to accomplish, the principles of a play or the techniques. And then you've got, you know, train the guys to do it when they're tired, when things aren't going well, in the most high-pressure type situations, on the biggest stages sometimes, or in the most mundane type situations when, you know, they're just tired or fatigued. Like any sport, you know, there's a psychology to it as well.
So is the playbook simply a mentality, a strategy, or is it written down? It's there in black and white.
Oh, the playbook's in black and white, and right. The playbook changes every week. So we have a big playbook, which we'd say that's our plays, our schemes. And within that, now, each week, we develop a strategy to attack the other person's plays. Not just the plays, but the way the plays apply within the talent, the athletic ability of the players and how they work together. How do our guys match up against their guys? What plays are going to work the best against their guys? What if they do this play? Well, we want to catch them in this play. And that's kind of the strategy, the back and forth of it. It's like every game is a new confrontation. Every play is a new confrontation. You're out there in the middle of the game, and you realize they're doing something a little bit differently than you thought they were going to do, and we have to make an adjustment and a change here.
Come on! Dean, I don't think we played cover one against these guys. Hey, 84 is going to be a big part of this game plan
now.
All that
stuff. Yep.
Then there's another, a whole nother level to this whole strategy is like, can we predict what they're going to do? Is there a tip? For instance, there are players in this league that by their the way they line up in their stance will tell you basically what their intentions are. Run or pass, pass rush, blitz. If we can see that and the quarterback can recognize that and change the play into a better play, that's where it really gets good.
Zoom, zebra left, 50 chip, flanker, arrow, on one, right?
Rabbit, rabbit!
Mike 5-6.
Kick, kick, kick!
Ladies
and! With the technology that we have these days, computerized technology especially, has the development of that playbook changed?
It's unbelievable. We are doing things that are just blow my mind compared to the 16 millimeter days. You know, we pat ourselves in the back a little bit, but we're the kind of cutting edge team with technology. And really, we're just following Europe. I mean, the European sports are way ahead of us in this area. So we've got the ability now, and we're learning how to quiz our players, how to put surveys out there and find out what they're thinking or what they really know, how to flashcard our players back and forth and have them answer questions for us, find out what they really know, teach them through interactive learning. Basically, we're trying, the next step is to create actual games that they can play that simulate the mental part of our sport. It's incredible.
And does the development of wearable technology, biometrics, does that all play into this as well?
Well, we're just getting into that. We're probably behind on that. That's something that you mentioned that we're just scratching the surface and learning about that right now. I'm really intrigued about where that can go.
Well, the potential is huge though, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be able to monitor physically how a player is doing at any particular time and how you could apply that to the game.
Well, how much force is a player applying to a block? Or how fast is a player running a streak route down the field? And you look at it and you go, I think you can run that faster. And he goes, I'm running it as fast as I can. And you can actually say, actually, you're not. You're running it at 78.6% of your full speed. How great would that be for a coach?
I mean, this must mean that you have to evolve yourself to be able to keep up with the technology.
We have a saying, adapt or die. We saw what happened to the dinosaurs, right? That's the greatest thing about, to me it would be any profession, but it's finding a new way to say something. It's finding a new way to phrase a coaching technique. Over the years, you might do a football clinic and you might explain something about a technique or a drill. And guys look at you kind of like sideways, tilt their head and kind of squint their eyes and go, I never heard it quite like that before. And I would think in my mind, you're one more person I just beat. You don't get it. There's a better way to do things. There's a better way to say things. There's a cleaner way to paint a picture for somebody. There's a better way to run a play, you know? That is the ultimate great thing about sport, that it's always evolving. Evolution, revolution, that was part of the political science deal, you know. Maybe in some ways it's revolution, it keeps coming back around, but in other ways it's evolution, man.
We've discussed actually how unique this sport is in terms of its methods and coaching, but I'm curious, do you look at other sports, maybe soccer, baseball, and how they're using and how they're developing with technology to try to learn from them?
You do. You look at the other sports in sense of like how far basically they're ahead of us. But the technology guys do that more than I do. What I look at is coaches in other sports. I'm a big Tony La Russa fan. I think Tony La Russa, he's a baseball coach for us. I love the way Tony La Russa coaches his teams. You know, I think the next thing for me is the other sports around the world. I would just like to hear what people say, how they talk to their guys, how they run a practice, you know, how they evaluate talent. To be able to sit down with a soccer coach from Europe, I can't even imagine how cool that would be, you know?
So with your role as the chief coach, does this mean that any sense of sort of micromanaging a situation is absolutely not what you do? You have to take that sort of umbrella approach and see all of these sides, all of these elements coming together?
Yes, you spend too much time, and I think there are some coaches in our sport that do that because they're an expert at one area, so they're not willing to let that area go. And they want to still be the coach of that area to the detriment of being the head coach and coaching the team. By the same token, you have to be involved in everything because everything ties together. The smallest details do tie into the big picture. So I think you've always got an eye for everything that's on the horizon, and you're looking for anything that doesn't fit with the big picture. So for some small part of our scheme that is out of place, that's not really working, or some player that his mindset or his mentality is a little bit out of place, doesn't seem right, I think you've got to be willing to jump on that right now directly one-on-one. I can't go through three layers of the flow chart to get a small problem solved. I've got to be able to go right to that problem, talk to that player, that coach, and get that thing, be able to recognize that thing and get it fixed, or work with them to get it fixed. Because why? Because it doesn't fit what we're trying to accomplish.
Do you find delegating as part of your personality an easy thing to do?
I think giving people an opportunity to achieve their own success is a very easy thing to do. So to me, delegating is a very simple word. Providing people an opportunity to achieve for themselves is really what you're all about.
Now, let's meet the AFC champions.
60 minutes away from world champions.
Football immortality.
Tonight we finish what we started.
They said we couldn't do it.
Right. Cut back, touchdown, Ravens!
We here.
Now it's Ravens' time. No doubt about it.
Dealing with these players, dealing with these huge personalities, these huge talents, they're extremely rich, they are extremely famous. How do you deal with the egos?
Right. Not all of them, you know. Most of them, you know, aren't that rich, aren't that famous. Most of our guys are young guys, just trying to make their way. They're like, they, you know, for guys our age, they'd be like our sons, you know. So you relate to them on it's a little bit fatherly, uncle, like, way older brother type relationship, I think. A lot of our guys, you know, sometimes the only people in their lives that have really held them accountable and really been there for them are their coaches, you know, so that really helps. So how do you do it? You do it in a human way, right? It's one-on-one. I think the whole great thing about this profession is being able to meet anybody where they're at, whether it's a rookie coming in trying to make the team as a free agent for the first time, whether it's an intern, equipment manager, who's just excited to be a part of your program, or whether it's a star quarterback making gobs of money. You've got to be able to meet every one of those people, you know, in their place, on their turf, where they're at, and find a way to, to bring the best out in them and hold them accountable.
And it all comes back to this, the team, the team, the team.
Right. How can anybody argue with that? Isn't that why we're here? I mean, isn't that what we're all about in the end? So, and that kind of is your point. That's the principal foundation point that nobody can argue with. So you can be the biggest star in the world, but if you're not about the team first in football, because this is a team sport, then you're just a selfish guy. And there's no place for selfishness in our sport. So it just doesn't work.
Yes! I'm gonna tell you what, you're one crazy son of a gun, man. Yeah. You are crazy. Great job. Woo!
Now here we are talking just before the beginning of yet another season. Do you have motivational sort of conversations, reminding, or maybe you doing the reminding of what the ultimate goal is? Yeah. And that ultimate goal presumably is another Super Bowl.
Well, we have a saying, and you saw it in our building, it's three letters, W-I-N, which we all know spells win, but there's also a period between each one of those letters. And it's really an acronym for what's important now. And really what we're talking about is a couple things. We're talking about process, and we're talking about the moment. Life is a series of moments. The greatest experiences in our life are always the greatest single moments that we have that we look back on and we'll remember for the rest of our lives. Yeah, we know the ultimate goal is the Super Bowl, but what's important now is all these stopping points along the way that are going to help us maybe get to that point. And that's really what's going to make us become who we are trying to become, which is a champion. You don't win a championship, you become a champion. So that's the process and that's the road that we're on every single day. And that's what we talk to our guys about.
And what if a player doesn't want to engage, maybe recoils into himself and almost rebels against you a little bit? I mean, does that scenario...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Happens all the time. Because it's tough, right? And guys, you know, I did the same thing as a player. We all do that. First of all, the standards are the same for everybody. So you can feel sorry for yourself. You can withdraw into yourself or whatever. But you still have to do the job. Or, you know, the most important thing is to recognize something like that. And if as a head coach, my eye is somewhere else, like how we're going to run a certain play all the time, as opposed to the human dynamic that's going on all around me, if I don't have an eye for that, then one after another, guys are going to fall away from you. And to me, that's when you lose a football team. So as soon as you sense that someone is moving in a place like that, it has to be addressed. Addressed in a way that you put your arm around the guy and just ask him, what's up? You know, what's going on? And they may come right back in your face and say, hey, what's going on here is BS. I don't like you. I don't appreciate what's going on. I don't believe in what you're doing. Okay, tell me why.
So perhaps there's some more empathy in the way that you approach your job than perhaps you saw from some of the old school guys.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't know about the old school. I think there were a lot. Doit Perry, who was my dad's coach, is a very empathetic coach and a tough coach. Now, you got to have your finger on every single guy. You got to find out what they're really thinking. Figure out what's really bothering them. It's really not usually how you run in practice. It's usually how much they're playing. They don't feel like they're having success or some problem they're having at home. And if you can get to the bottom of it, you can usually get it fixed. Now, I do have a little thing, like even when you can't get it fixed, I'll always leave it this. You know, one of the guiding principles is you never let the sun go down on your anger or on a rift in a relationship. So, you know, I'm always going to leave the day with at least I'm okay with you or you're okay with me, even if I'm not okay with you. You know, you're good. Don't worry. You're good with me. I know you're pissed at me, but that's okay. We'll see each other tomorrow.
It's a bit of a broad statement, but I wonder if it's fair to say that the sport used to be a lot simpler, that things, maybe for the better with the technology that you've discussed with me, have kind of changed the sport, made it in terms of the talent of the players and bringing out the talent, it's more exciting. But is there a danger of becoming too complicated and moving away from some of those basic simple principles?
Yes, because I don't think it won't be a phenomenon in the sport, because as soon as you start, it's a discipline within as a coach. As soon as you start moving into that area, you don't execute as well because the players can't assimilate it all and execute on the field. It still goes back to the player and what the player can actually do on the field in real time, in the heat of battle, under pressure, in any sport. And as soon as you start making it too complicated, now the player just gets confused. He's got too much on his plate and he can't perform.
And do you think what you do is a science or an art?
It's definitely both. It's definitely both. There's empirical evidence involved in what we do, and there's a whole lot of what's on that screen, on that video TV right there. When we put our football on that screen, that is our work of art. That's our Picasso. That's our Monet. You know, those are two pretty good artists. We'll go with those two guys. You know, that's what it is. And yet what your signature is on that painting right there. And as a coach and a player, you need to put your name on that and make it right.
Well, your name, or at least the team's name, is on Super Bowl 2013 from the 2012 season. Let's just talk about that experience and, of course, up against your brother from the San Francisco 49ers.
Jim Harbaugh is on the near sideline. That's where the San Francisco 49ers are. John Harbaugh, his brother, is on the opposite sideline for the Baltimore Ravens. The first time in the 47-year history of the Super Bowl that brothers have coached on opposite sides of the field.
Great media story. Is it a story that you would have necessarily wanted to happen?
yes and no. I'm forever grateful, incredible to be a part of it. Just ridiculously hard to go through, but you're competing against your brother, so you know, it's not like it was new for us. It was just crazy for it to be on that crazy stage. The real story to me is way bigger than that. It's the story of our team. I'm sure and his team has his story and his journey, but you know, the days are long, but the years are short. And the process of going through and the human events that took place that take a football team and push guys into that brotherhood, forge guys into that titanium strong bond that gives you a chance to overcome and perform on those kind of stages, that's what you remember. And it's usually built around adversity and tragedy and overcoming those things, which is what life is all about. And that's why football is a great metaphor for life. I'm sure like most sports are, but to me, none more so than football.
Running back with it, Ted Ginn Jr. Ted Ginn's out to the 45. He's still on his feet to the 50.
That's it.
That's where he's dragged down. No time on the clock. The Baltimore Ravens spill onto the field. The Baltimore Ravens are Super Bowl 47 champions.
And when it became clear to you that you were the coach of the team that was about to become the winning team at Super Bowl 2013, and this is the year that Beyoncé performed at halftime, that there was an unprecedented blackout in the stadium that delayed things for a while, it was quite a year, but you realized you were about to win. What was the emotion going through your body at that time?
You know, why did it have to be so hard? I mean, I see these coaches, they're up like this year 43-8, and he knows he's got like a whole half to enjoy the win. We snatched victory from the jaws of defeat right there at the end against my brother.
John Harbaugh is being congratulated on the field. He's been through the ringer tonight, just like his brother Jim. One of the Baltimore players.
What it was like was a moment of, like, at the same time, all kind of energy and invigoration, just and power going into your body. At the same time, all kind of emotion just leaving you like in an instant. And then having the realization that Your life has changed forever. Okay, all of ours. I told the team before the game, if we win this game, when we win this game, we will walk together forever. And that is true. And you realize that it actually happened. We will walk together forever as champions. And then at the same time realize, now I got to walk across the field and shake my brother's hand, my own flesh and blood, who just experienced the exact opposite emotion. So, you know, that was, I don't think too many people have experienced that before.
Have you talked to your brother much about that moment and your feelings afterwards?
Nah. We've joked about it. We've had a couple talks. Well, most of our talks have been about the game and, you know, some of the nuances of the game, you know, and some of the calls that the officials made or whatever he had a problem with. You know, we had a classic brother conversations about after a game. You know, it's not sitting too well with him, but he's proud of me, and I'm proud of him, and I'm just darn glad we won.
And how do you move forward? How do you approach the next season, having achieved that? I mean, actually, is it difficult to regain the motivation that you previously had?
No, more determination. The thing that I found was we had, you know, personally, more determination than ever, because you do not want to slide back, and you do not want it to go that direction, and you're very conscious of the fact that people might think that you're going to become complacent. So I was more determined than ever. And you know what? We still slid back. We still went 8-8, because there were a lot of things that happened that were. It's a short off season, and guys get a lot of attention, and we lost a lot of good players. But it wasn't that we didn't work hard, and it wasn't that we didn't give it everything we had. Because what happened was we started off, we had a tough first half, and we fought back out of that hole and got ourselves back in playoff contention. So to me, that showed the heart and character of our football team. And at the end, we didn't have enough gas to find our way into the playoffs. So in a way, I feel like last year was a better coaching job than the year before, believe it or not, and now even more determined than ever. I mean, this is high stakes. This is high competition. The fun of this is the competition.
And do you still pinch yourself and maybe remember those childhood conversations when I think it was your dad who would say to you, "It doesn't get any better than this." Do you still feel that?
Yeah, he also said, "Attack." He would drive us to school in his 1962 Chevy Biscayne. With the three on the tree, and we'd get out of the car and he'd say, "Attack this day with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind." We're like in third grade. An enthusiasm, that's a big thought. Unknown to mankind? I pinch myself when I think of those things.
Well, this has been a really fascinating insight into your sport. John Harbaugh, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's an honor.
You've been listening to The Managers. I'm Peter Bowes. The program was made in association with the Open University and was produced for the BBC World Service by Richard McElroy. If you'd like to find out more about sports leadership and coaching, go to the Sports Managers program page on the World Service website and follow the links to the Open University.